Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. Now I want us all to be very mature here, because this is episode XXX, pause for sniggering, Vitellius. When we last left the civil war of 64 CE, Galba was defeated, Otho was defeated, and now Vitellius becomes emperor. He's got the things that everybody wants in a good emperor. He's got a military background, he's been a politician, but as we'll soon see, there's a lot more to being emperor than having a good resume. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The third emperor of 69 CE is Aulus Vitellius, also a military man, also a governor, like the previous emperors of 69. But he is stationed in the north, so he's a governor or a general in Germany. He's in his 50s by the time we get to 69 CE, and he comes from the right kind of background in terms of political nous. So his father's been consul a number of times. He has also been consul, and he's previously been a governor of another province towards the south in Africa. So he's got lots of experience. And he's got both military and political experience.
This sounds like the perfect person to be emperor on paper. This is why you can't trust resumes.
No, exactly. As it turns out, at least as described by the biographers and historians, Vitellius is pretty much a disaster as an emperor. So he will be overthrown. There will be a fourth emperor in 69 CE.
So what do we know specifically about the young Vitellius then?
Well, like some of the other emperors of the year of four emperors, he did have links with the Julio-Claudians, and his family were particularly nurtured by Tiberius. And the rumour was, and decide whether you believe any of these rumours, that Vitellius had been one of the boy loves of Tiberius because he'd spent some of his youth on the island of Capri, where Tiberius had gone into that self-imposed exile towards the end of his reign.
That would have made him one of the alleged young boys that would swim through Tiberius's legs in the pool.
Presumably so.
That's a great link to have for an emperor.
And some people with suspicious minds had linked the rise of Vitellius's family, so the fact that his father became consul numerous times, to the fact that, you know, Vitellius was on the island of Capri, so it was kind of payback.
Family favours, which is plausible.
Not impossible, for sure. Well, he certainly spent time around Caligula when he was emperor. Apparently Caligula ran over Vitellius with his chariot. It doesn't seem to have been malicious. At least nobody mentions that Caligula does it deliberately, and they probably would, because usually they try to blacken Caligula as much as possible. But it meant that Vitellius did have a permanent disability after that. So there's a permanent reminder of Caligula actually written onto poor old Vitellius's body.
In addition to that, he's described as being very tall and very, I'm going to put it as rotund. He must have been a very imposing figure.
Yes, and the tallness is almost put as a negative, which sounds very strange to us, but it's combined with the fact that Vitellius is really overweight, and that is directly connected by Suetonius to the fact that he's a glutton, and Suetonius spends a lot of the biography talking about how much Vitellius consumes, that he never stops consuming, basically.
That, as it is, being run over by Caligula and swimming between the legs of Tiberius, establishes Vitellius's credentials. So what was he doing to get the backing of the troops in Germany, in Germania?
Well done. He had been sent to Germania by Galba. This mystifies people a bit because he didn't have an awful lot of military experience before that. But there is a general idea that Galba was trying to sort of neutralize him as a threat. It's clearly a mistake, because he thought by kind of sending him far enough away and putting him in charge of the German troops that he wouldn't be a danger back in Rome.
Because it worked so well for Galba and Otho.
I guess he thought that he'd have enough troubles there that he had to deal with. Mm. But yeah, it was an absolute miscalculation by Galba, and history has borne out that putting people in charge of an army, although Augustus knew this, I don't know why Galba didn't know it. If you put people somewhere where they're in charge of troops, they can use those troops against you.
Yeah.
So you've got to be careful who you put in charge. But I guess that maybe Galba's rationale was that Vitellius wouldn't be that kind of challenge, that if he was a challenge, it would be political, as he came, you know, he had a good political pedigree, that he might be able to rouse the Senate.
So was he a popular leader then in Germania, or was it just a lot of disgruntled military?
No, well, he must have been popular because the German troops pronounced him emperor in January 69, and he seems to have treated them well. Certainly once he gets in power, he, like Otho, knows you've got to pay them off. You've got to make sure that you've got the troops on side. He seems to be popular with the troops, although for reasons that some historians, Roman historians, ancient Roman historians disapprove of, is that he sort of indulges them because he's so prodigal himself. He just gives them lots of things, and that's not really a way to ensure long-term discipline.
So he delegates the actual battles to two of his generals. His troops are marched towards Rome while Galba is still emperor. Galba dies and he meets Otho's troops in battle, and Otho's troops are defeated, thereby leaving Vitellius as emperor.
Yeah.
So at this point, he's got victory, and he celebrates by going from Germania to Rome and feasting the entire way. So he's breezed into the emperorship, hasn't he?
In a way, he has. I mean, I guess he sent his troops down at the right time, but he's also been lucky by the fact that Otho got rid of Galba for him.
And he's also lucky because he's got two quite competent generals who completely support him.
Yes, you've always got to have the right people in support. And it means that Vitellius can, by all accounts, just give himself up to his own appetites, which is what he seems to have been interested in doing. So we have accounts of him feasting and really spending an awful lot of money on this feasting. And that kind of account makes him look like a bad emperor, not only because he's spending lots of money, but it means he can't control his appetites. So Suetonius, in one of the most outrageous passages about Vitellius, says that he was addicted to luxury and to cruelty, always having at least three feasts, sometimes four in a day. And he doesn't just mean four meals, like we might have three or four and think that's okay. He means banquets.
Mm.
And easily finding capacity for it through regular vomiting. So that's pretty disgusting. Moreover, he would have himself invited for each meal by a different host on the same day. No one ever spent less than 400,000 sesterces in making provision for one of these meals.
Wow.
That's a huge fortune in itself. Among all these feasts, the most notorious was the one given by his brother to mark his arrival in Rome as emperor, at which were served 2,000 of the choicest fish and 7,000 birds, so they say. But this too he himself outdid when he dedicated the platter, which because of its immense size he used to call the Shield of Minerva. This is my favourite meal, the Shield of Minerva. It's huge. And what it contains is the blended livers of scarfish, the brains of pheasants and peacocks, and the tongues of flamingos, along with the innards of lampreys, so fish again, which had been sought out by ship's captains and galleys from Parthia. Flamingos are not native.
No, it sounds like a massive amount of prep time in that one dish.
Yes. So it's not just about the amount that he's eating. He's getting it from the farthest reaches of the empire. So in a way, even his gluttony is a way of showing his power, that he can afford and has the power to get things from the different parts of the empire here.
That's Vitellius arriving in Rome.
Hmm.
And if that's a precursor of what sort of emperor he's going to be, that doesn't sound like he's going to leave a lot of room for competent ruling.
No, well, he certainly doesn't stay popular for very long.
Was he popular at all?
Well, he's popular with his own troops, at least briefly. And he manages to get the Praetorian Guard on side, but not so much by getting them on side as by getting rid of them and replacing them with people that he knows will be favourable to him.
So that's rewarding his own troops who have done well by him.
It's quite a sensible thing to do because the Praetorian Guard can obviously, they're going to be very close to the emperor. They can get rid of him at a moment's notice.
It's happened before.
It has happened before that they've been a danger. He does the sensible thing there, but he kind of forgets about everybody else. You know, he's sort of gives a general amnesty to Otho's troops and supporters, but he doesn't really deal with them. He doesn't butter them up in any way. He just neglects them. So he's leaving trouble for himself there, potentially. And he's also just got a very bad reputation, partly because of the eating, partly because he apparently treats his own family very badly. He's rumoured to have killed his own son and also his mother on the basis of a prophecy that if she did not outlive him, then he would have a long and prosperous reign. So
right.
He reads this as, I've got to get rid of my mother.
It's worth wading into that a bit because he had a problem with astrologers, didn't he? The first reference that I came across, when Vitellius was born, his astrological chart wasn't favourable, and it said that if he became somebody of power, if he had ranking of, say, a governor or a consul, that he would soon die. So his parents were actively trying to keep him out of roles of power for a while. And when he became the governor of Germania, his mother essentially wrote him off going, oh, well, so much for that son, essentially.
Yeah, the Romans were very, what we would regard as superstitious about astrology and about portents. And actually having a chart done is quite a political thing to do. You know, I don't know if you remember when we looked at Tiberius, we might have mentioned that it was a capital crime to do the chart of Tiberius because you might foresee something which would lead to his death. So they really believe that these have power, these charts. Suetonius likes to report the portents and what's going on with astrology. Of course, he's only going to report the stuff that's actually borne out by what he knows has happened historically.
Mm.
But there is a good chance that the parents were shocked by this chart, and maybe they did try and prevent him coming to power. But it never works, does it?
This is Suetonius who said that. When he was sent to the legions and hailed as emperor, his mother immediately mourned over him as lost.
Yes. But she shouldn't have mourned because he was then going to starve her to death.
He himself, though, had a lot of distrust for astrologers because one of the things that he did while being in power was he banned astrologers and executed a lot of them as well.
That's not necessarily about distrust. It's actually more likely to mean that he did believe what they were saying and he didn't want it made public. This happens periodically, actually, under the emperors, that if they don't like what is being said by astrologers, they'll throw them out of the city. It's quite a dangerous job to have because, you know, given the temper of the emperor on any given day, you might be excluded, executed, whatever, quite often exiled, because he doesn't like the kind of rumors that what you're saying might generate. All right, so it's hard for us to imagine. We sort of regard these charts and these predictions as almost entertainment, I suppose. The emperors took them very seriously as political vehicles, something that might foment some kind of trouble because there's a rumor that bloodshed is coming or that the emperor hasn't got long to go. That might actually precipitate some kind of rebellion against the emperor.
The one notable thing that I did find out about Vitellius is that he didn't use the honorific of Caesar. He used Germanicus instead.
That's right. Well, this is supposed to have been what his troops hailed him as. And of course, his troops are in Germania, so it makes sense.
The other reason that I kind of thought of is that the person Germanicus, being the brother of Claudius, seemed to have been quite a missed figure in Rome after he died. So it might be trying to hail back to somebody in the Julio-Claudians that people all admired.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going back decades now, but Germanicus is the perfect example of what we were talking about when we mentioned Otho and the people who don't last very long, don't get to actually show whether they're a good or a bad ruler. They just have promise. And Germanicus never gets to be emperor, but he is a very successful military general, much loved by his troops. So he's exactly the kind of figure that you want to recall. But it is also an honorific that's been used by others if they've had success against the Germani. So the most direct connection probably is to Germanicus, but it generally means, you know, I have had victories over Germanic tribes. But it also suggests some kind of restraint, which we don't normally associate with Vitellius, because he accepts that name. He only accepts the name Augustus, which is the name that all emperors get at some stage, you know, when he actually gets to Rome. And he never accepts the name Caesar. He's trying to look restrained, at least. He's not just stepping straight into that role and saying, I am Augustus Caesar. He's sort of biding his time with the nomenclature.
So given that Vitellius is only emperor for 8 months, it's clear that the next contender is rapidly approaching Rome. So that's Vespasian. So where's he coming from?
He's governor out in Judea, in the Middle East, and he's conducting a war there at this point, in which he's having quite a bit of success. And he's sort of repeating that pattern that, you know, your troops will declare you emperor, and then you probably march on Rome and take over from the previous incumbent. And that is what happens in the middle of the year of 69. His troops name him as emperor, and he gets a lot of support from other troops in the east around the Euphrates and Parthia. And they begin to march on Rome because they're coming from a lot further away. It takes them a while to get there. But Vitellius can never really be at ease. So Vespasian's troops come from the east, and they have a battle in northern Italy, actually very close to the same place where Otho was defeated by Vitellius, near Cremona. So there's a kind of irony about history repeating itself there.
Less than a year later.
Exactly, within the same year in 69 CE. And it's a very eventful year. And then they work their way down to Rome, where there's a lot of shilly-shallying going on Vitellius's part. He tries to sort of appease Vespasian's troops, and Vespasian is kind of dealing through his brother, Sabinus. And he says that he'll sort of resign and give up. And then apparently he's popular with some of the people because they hail him and sort of try and bring him back. And he changes his mind, which is a stupid thing to do because Vespasian's troops are kind of in charge at this point. You've basically got civil war in the heart of Rome at that point because there's kind of open fighting on the streets. And most momentous of all, Vitellius's troops burn down the Temple of Jupiter, where a lot of Vespasian's followers are hiding out, including Sabinus and Vespasian's son, Domitian. It's going to be a good chance for Vespasian to rebuild, by the way, afterwards. And there's mayhem in the streets. And eventually, Vitellius is just dragged out of hiding, and he is maltreated in the most awful way.
I've got here that according to Tacitus, Vitellius was dragged out by the troops of Vespasian from a doorkeeper's lodge where he'd been hiding alone, dressed as a commoner.
Yeah, he's attempting to disguise himself and get away that way, but it doesn't work. So there's this kind of deceit right at the end of poor old Vitellius's life. You know, he really should have given himself up earlier because he has the most horrible, violent end where he's tortured to death by Vespasian's supporters, very slowly, apparently. And then his body is put onto hooks, which is what they do to criminals, and thrown into the Tiber. So no respect at the end, no burial, no honours given to him at all. It's one of the most nasty ends of any of the emperors.
Little piece of trivia, where he was struck down on the Gemonian stairs was the same place where Sejanus died, the person who tried to betray Tiberius.
So Vitellius spends a lot of time having history repeat itself and not learning the lessons that he should have, perhaps.
So at that point, Vespasian becomes emperor.
He does, yes, late in 69, so in December, only just making it into 69. The war in the east isn't finished. That has to be completed by his son Titus. Vespasian comes back to Rome, and he is going to be the successful emperor of the year of the four emperors. Okay, you imagine you'd be quite nervous because they're getting knocked off very quickly here. But as we'll see, he is the one who manages to maintain a 10-year emperorship and to start a new dynasty.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe on iTunes, and please leave a review and tell your friends about it. We've got a companion podcast which you can now subscribe to called When in Rome, which is about place and space in the Roman Empire. You can like us on Facebook, where we've just passed 1,000 Facebook fans, and we've also got some illustrations there of the Roman emperors during 64 CE by the Canadian storyboard artist Rich Morris. He also writes webcomics, and you should check out his work, including yet another fantasy gamer comic and the Rome set House of Paulus, which is available in print. And we've got links to both of those on our Facebook page. You can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. The next episode of Emperors of Rome will see the rise of the Emperor Vespasian, a final end to the Civil War, and the establishment of the Flavian Dynasty. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.